Welcome to Too Many Podcasts. We start season 4 with Hollywood Week in the Sherpa screening room. By the way, I'm Bill, one of the Sherpa Lou Studios players. I'm doing this because the Sherpa is too cheap to pay real actors or real people. So, feel free to blame him for the bad jokes.
I think they were blaming him for the bad jokes in season 1 anyway.
Maybe even before the podcast started.
Let's see how many bad jokes he makes with today's guest, Pat Jenkowitz.
I've got 20 books riding on at least 5.
Attention, rebels of the Sherpalution. Today's podcast is being brought to you by Audible. You can get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/sherpa. There are over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. And now Mr. Bruce will lead you into the Sherpa Chalet. As a reminder, please don't disturb the yak.
Coming to you from Sherpa Chalet in beautiful downtown Mount Podcastia, it's time for entertainment interviews in the Sherpa screening room. Grab an aisle seat and a bucket of popcorn, but don't crunch too loud or you'll miss the show. Now, here's your host, Jim, the podcast Sherpa.
What? Season 4 already? Are you kidding me? Yes, here we are, folks. A new season, a new intro. Thank you so much, Mr. Bruce, for your creation. A welcome back to season 4 of Too Many Podcasts, and this is the Sherpa Screening Room. I'm Jim, the podcast Sherpa. Of course it is. It's me. Look. Yep, it's me. Okay. We hope you really enjoy this season. I'm really looking forward to some of the episodes that we'll be playing for you this season, and I hope that you'll enjoy them too. And don't forget about seasons 1 through 3 and all the good stuff that's in there as well. About this week's guest. It's Hollywood Week, folks, so we've got a couple of shows for you this week, starting it off with one of my favorite interviews of the year, and I had a lot of fun with this guy. His name is Pat Jenkowitz. He is an actor who's done lots of movies, and he's been in some 90s rock videos, and he's a podcaster, and he's got a ton of stories. He's also an author who's got books that are encyclopedias of knowledge of pop culture. The guy's incredible. I really like talking to him. I think you're really going to like listening to what he has to say. So let's kick off season 4 with my conversation with Pat Jenkowitz. Hello, Rebels. I am with one of my faves today. He is an actor. He is a writer. And I guess we could call him a pop culture historian, judging by the books that he's written. He's been a 90s music video vixen, because I couldn't think of a better word to use. And he's also
slightly
been
slightly painful.
And he's also the co-host.
These video vixens, my looks have fallen.
He's also the co-host of the Jeff and Janky Show. His name is Pat Jenkowitz. Pat, welcome to the Sherpa Screening Room.
I'm honored to be here, Podcast Sherpa. How are you doing out there in Long Island?
I am doing well. And, you know, I was just thinking as we were talking before we set up, you're probably the only guest I've ever had on this show who's worked with a kangaroo and has gotten ice cream from Joey Buttafuoco.
This is true. This is true. The ice cream didn't give me, the kangaroo didn't give me ice cream. But yes, Joey Buttafuoco, he came down on a commercial I was doing. I was in a commercial. And on the break, the producer said, hey, everyone, I got you everyone a treat. Go on out and grab the cast and crew. Go on out and grab some ice cream. And there's this big guy with the, you know, and I'm 6'9". I'm big. But Joey was kind of wide. But he's wearing the little paper hat on his head and everything. So I walk up. And, you know, I asked for, like, an ice cream bar, and he hands me a huge one. I look up, and I go, well, thank you. And then my next words were literally what I saw, Joey Buttafuoco. You know, he was driving a Mr. Frosty truck, and he was serving the ice cream himself, so I got to give him props for that. But again, it was like OJ serving you ice cream, you know? You don't expect it.
Well, I'm thinking, like, well, what if he asked you if you wanted extra sprinkles, and you said, like, oh, yeah, I need sprinkles, like I need a hole in the head.
I need extra sprinkles, like I need a hole in your wife's head. Might have been too soon.
We're already in trouble now, Pat.
Yeah. That's New York humor. Go with it.
That's right. That's right. So did you originally start as an actor or as a writer? Because I know there was a lot of writing going on and still is with you.
Well, the amazing thing about it is acting, writing led to the acting part. My brothers, Don and Tom, they were running commercials. They were doing commercials on the side. And my brother, Don and Tom, and I wrote a commercial for David Lynch. And David Lynch wound up casting me in it, which, you know, so that's literally writing leading to a commercial. I thought I was going to slide into WGA and the rest is history. And instead, it got me my SAG card. And I found, you know, for articles and option stuff and everything, that money's good, but commercial money is huge. You know what I mean? I mean, I had a commercial run. Do you have Hardee's in New York or Carl's Jr.?
They used to have Hardee's. They don't have too many roast beef places, but I know what you're talking about, though.
Okay, I did a Hardee's Carl's Jr. commercial that ran for 5 years where I was a singing waiter who introduced the world of the $6 burger, which if you have a Hardee's or Carl's Jr., you know damn well what the $6 burger is. And it was really depressing because it was the easiest gig I've ever done. And the checks kept coming. And I'm thinking all these articles and stuff I'm knocking my brains in. And this silly 3-hour, 2-day commercial of 3 hours of work, it became these, you know what I mean? I mean, it's so having that, to me, the journalism and the writing, it was a hand in both worlds. I would audition for somebody big. You know what I mean? And you'll be just another 40 faces wanting to go in and see the guy and talk to the guy in addition. But as a journalist, I would sit down with some of the biggest names and they were excited to see me. It was different when you were an actor looking for a gig than when you're a writer, you're in charge. James Cameron made time for me. You know, a bunch of Brad Silberling, Natalie Portman, everybody, Christian Bale, Christopher Nolan. I mean, when you're the guy doing the article, you're shaping their destiny. So instead of being the actor, which I don't knock, I enjoy doing it. You know what I mean? The money when you're hired is good. But the cool thing is that's a completely different experience from going into the office with 40 other guys trying to do something the other 40 haven't done. To when you're coming in to meet Christopher Nolan, Nolan is going to answer your questions, and he's happy to do so because he wants a good article. And if you ask the right questions, the interview goes on and on. You know what I mean? I mean, when I started out, when my family moved to California, I'd always been into movies. I'd always been excited about movies. So when I was in high school, my brother Donald and I would crash movie sets, and I would watch how things were working. And again, I lied and said it was from like a magazine, even though I wasn't even shaving yet. And the director would just come sit down with me and answer all my questions. They'd show me around the set. No idea. It was just a dumb kid having some fun on them. But I was always very tall. And since I was taller than them, they assumed I was professional, which was kind of hilarious. So that one has always led to the other. You know what I mean? I mean, I've written for a bunch of magazines. I write for Star Wars Insider now. I write for one that's in every Barnes & Noble in the country. Star Wars is too, as is Star Trek Monthly. But I also write for like Infinity. The best magazines right now are being done in England. No, English magazines covering American pop culture are really fascinating to me, you know what I mean? And so I'm like their token American writing about this for them. They fetishize American culture in a way that we do not, you know? guys, it's just an episode of Star Trek, you know? Not a religious awakening or anything.
And you used to write for Fangoria when you were in college?
I did. I started, in college, I started running, and it was hilarious because when I was in high school, a couple of the sets I crashed where I lied and told them I was Fangoria. And I remember one of the editors, I wrote them a pitch letter. And you know, one of the editors turned around and called me, and he was such a dick. He called me at Wendy's. I was working at Wendy's in high school. And my manager says, it's a man from New York, and he's calling to talk to you. And I remember answering the phone, and this Fangoria editor, and I was so excited. I thought, he's going to hire me, and I'm going to throw my hat on the ground and quit Wendy's. And he goes, I just want you to know one thing before I slam this phone down. Our magazine's written for teenage boys, not by them. Which I thought was incredibly mean. So in college I started running. I was working four jobs and trying to finish up. You know, I worked at a movie theater. I worked at Trader Joe's. So I did all these side jobs. And then I found my set crashing. I could do a set visit for real. You know, and I got my SAG card in college as well. So if I did a set visit, I thought I can do everything I want to do and need to do and then just get the hell out of there and make 10 times the money. I mean, a set visit now, when you go there as Fangoria, when I'm in college, I would go there as Fangoria or whatever else, or Starburst or Wizard. I wrote for Wizard as well. You would go, and then everyone you interviewed, you could turn into a separate article. So you could walk away with 10 interviews and have 10 articles, which would carry you the next year of magazine work on the side, you know?
In all those time of doing interviews, were there any specific interviews that really kind of stick out in your head?
Yeah, the ones that really blew your mind. In college, William Friedkin let me shadow him for a week, the director of The Exorcist. You know, I wrote a defense to the local newspaper on him. He saw it and agreed, it called me up to thank me and let me follow him around for a week. Sam Raimi not only liked when my brother and I interviewed him, but Sam Raimi would bring you a can of 7-Up himself. I was really impressed with that. As successful as he was, so I interviewed Sam Raimi and I interviewed Sam Raimi's mother. So that was really kind of great because Sam Raimi's mother was a really hip chick, you know, an older lady, but you could see where he and Bruce Campbell and all those guys from Celia, this amazing woman, you know, and I interviewed one of Raimi's people, an actor who's been in a bunch of Sam Raimi movies, Timothy Patrick Quill. He's the blacksmith in Army of Darkness. He's the cop who yells at Peter Parker for not stopping the guy who kills Uncle Ben. He liked me and my brother because we were from Michigan and we were green. So he let us come hang out at Renaissance all summer when Renaissance used to be on Hollywood Boulevard. So we learned a ton of stuff from him. You would do an interview. You would do these interviews. My late brother Tom is a writer, and he told me he got like four ideas coming on two interviews. On the same day, I interviewed Harry Essex. Because, I mean, as a film buff, you want to get the people no one is talking to. There was all these old writers and old Hollywood greats were sitting around and no one was bothering to talk to them. So I wound up interviewing a guy named Harry Essex who wrote It Came From Outer Space, The Sons of Cain the Elder, The Original Creature from the Black Lagoon. And nobody's talking to him. And so his stories are great and he tell you interesting stuff. On the same day as that, I interviewed Jeffrey Boehm, who wrote Lost Boys, Inner Space, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, The Phantom. So it was like a masterclass in writing from these two guys. I mean, you're at the Warner Brothers lot. And Mel Gibson is coming by, and that's not so impressive anymore. Mel Gibson and Danny Glover are coming by Jeffrey Boehm's office and stuff. But at the time, it was very cool. No, and now it's not. But Jeffrey Boehm had written everything. And to sit there while he'd walk you through his process was just amazing.
Let's talk a little bit about your commercial background. Didn't you do a Burger King commercial? You were suspended from a crane?
Wow. Okay. I'm in the last of the Twilight Burger King commercial. It was a tie-in for one of the Twilight movies. So I'm 40 feet in the air. I'm on a girder, and they have us over an honest-to-God construction site. I think I'm Team Jacob, and the other hard hat is Team Edward. You know, and we're supposedly fighting. And the Burger King, when they had the Burger King completely encased in like bronze, he comes down on a girder and he gives me a big he gives me a Whopper. And we both take Whoppers and that ends our feud. But the amazing thing to me is they were using an honest to God Pasadena construction site. So we are literally 40 feet in the air and they've got these scary spikes coming up underneath us. Rebar, thank you. My brother corrected me. Scary spikes are known as rebar, the basic building foundation of any house or building.
Thank you, Donald.
Yeah, thank you, Donald. The Sherpa thanks you. So what happens is we're on this Pasadena construction site and we're hanging and they put us in the safety harness. You know, we have the safety harness. And I'm telling the other hard hat, you know what'd be cool? If we're all harnessed in, we ought to, when we're done with the commercial, we ought to just flip off the girder and it'll hold us in the air. It'd be like a free bungee jump. And he thought about it. And I said, as soon as we're done, we can grab our arms and then just tandem flip off the off this giant girder. And he goes, the director likes us. We don't want to look unprofessional. And I agreed with him. And then the stunt coordinator comes by and he goes, thank God you guys didn't slip. I didn't have time to attach your safety harnesses. So my testicles retracted into my body and I lost every ounce of blood. It was just kind of horrible. It was kind of horrifying. I almost committed suicide on the Burger King commercial. On the bright side of this commercial is for 4 hours, I got to eat Whoppers, because of the Burger King kept bringing us Whoppers. And it was hilarious because even though we're 40 feet in the air, the food stylist, they're painting the food and everything, that was non-toxic paint. You can eat it. And that's one of the things in the commercial. So you have these artistic people who will glaze and paint your food. Truth in advertising is like when I did a Coca-Cola commercial. They used a larger box for the coat. The red boxes you see when you buy in the stores? There's a brighter shade of red that they're not allowed to use in stores that they use in commercials. And the boxes are physically bigger. No UPC code, no contents. So, and it's an eye-catching red. So what happens is you learn all this. But the other guy had a spit bucket. And he was taking a bite and spitting it in. They came up on the crane to dump our spit buckets, of all the mashed hamburgers. And she goes, Larry's is full of half-eaten food and Pat's is empty. And she goes, you haven't been throwing them on the ground, have you? She goes, where have you been putting them? And I rubbed my stomach and she started laughing. The saddest drawback I've had in entertainment was when the creatives decided, the Burger King executives and the food stylist agreed that I shouldn't take a bite of it because they said Pat's hands are making the Whoppers look like the Whopper Jr. They go, this is not the 99-cent Whopper Jr., but our actor, every time he takes the burger in his hands, it looks like a 99-cent burger. So they said they had Burger King hold it in front of me and I kind of take a whiff of it, but don't touch the food because I was making it look too small. That made me so sad. I was ready to cry.
Now, you actually told me, I remember the last time that we spoke, you got to play your dream role as Bigfoot.
I am Bigfoot, I am Bigfoot. If you have Amazon Prime, you will see the movie Hoax, starring Ben Browder and Brian Thompson from The Terminator, Cobra, tons of other stuff. Spoiler alert, I eat both of them.
That's a pretty big spoiler.
No spin buckets there either, by the way. That was a lot of ham.
Oh man.
Thank you. My brother looked at me with his finger on his nose and said, terrible. But yeah, so Bigfoot, it was a blast. We did it on a mountaintop in Lake City, Colorado, 18,000 feet above sea level. We're at the top of this mountain. The effects guy and I shared a cabin. We had deer in our yard every morning, every night. You would see caribou and elk and all sorts of animals, but rabbits unlike you've ever seen, coyotes. You would see animals you've never seen on a daily basis wandering through the yard of this cabin. We had a frontier cemetery walking down the hill. And of course, I'm sharing a cabin with him. So Bigfoot's entire body had hands feet around our living room table. And, there's like a severed head from one of the victims laying on top of the toilet and all this other stuff. It was kind of cool because it was like, I joked we were like cannibals living in the wild because there'd be this screaming head on top of the toilet and, a severed arm would be in the kitchen foyer Bill Munns who'd and believe it or not, years before as a kid I'd met him while I was a teenage set crasher, and Bill Munns is one of those guys. He did all the Sun Classic Bigfoot movies. He did all the Creatures and Beastmaster except Tanya Roberts. So he did the original Return of the Living Dead. He's the guy who designed the original Swamp Thing. Every Swamp Thing that's been done since then was trying to copy Bill's work, which is kind of cool. The great thing is, again, doing a Bigfoot movie in Colorado, I met the most famous man in Colorado, which was the guy who played the cannibal, Alfred Packer. You heard of Alfred Packer?
Doesn't ring a bell.
The South Park guys. Well, they, when they're in college, they made a student film musical, which was hilarious and loved in the area, called Alfred Packer the Musical, about this cannibal who ate five people. Yeah, but when they went when they sold the movie right before South Park, they sold it to Lloyd Kaufman and Troma. And the first thing he did was mess with their title. They're like, you can't change the title. And he goes, F you. And playfully, he said, F you. No one outside of Colorado knows who Alfred Packer is, but they'll know Cannibal the Musical. And we were in the town the Cannibal was from. And when I wasn't working, because, you know, Bigfoot worked at night. So during the day, everyone else was in the mountains, you know, oh, there's a footprint. Oh, I smell Bigfoot. Bigfoot only worked at night. So the entire cast and crew was getting blasted, you know, working in the mountains. I would go sightseeing in the town. Because again, until when you're doing all the, what does the tracker say? Beep, 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 he's over here, you know. And I knew because Bigfoot didn't work at night. I literally wandered this tiny town. They were really nice. It was literally, I mean, they'd overcharge wildly. You know, they covered my groceries, but I remember paying $6 for Pop-Tarts, for off-brand Pop-Tarts. And I thought, oh, no. I will never live in a small mountain town ever. They would watch movies in a Quonset hut. Some Harley Quinn thing would be showing, and the local theater was a Quonset hut. And all the dogs and cats in this town, because it was so cold, had 5 layers of fur, because it was so damn cold. Even in the summer, we were shooting this thing in the summer, and it was frigging snowing in the mountains. I couldn't believe that, you know?
You said you used to camp as a kid, and you always used to be kind of scared about Bigfoot, right?
Terrified of Bigfoot. My grandmother and my aunt and uncle and cousins all live in the... My mom is from Seattle. So all of that side of the family is in the Pacific Northwest. And I'd seen some Bigfoot documentary, you know, one of the knock documentaries on Detroit TV. And I think I saw either a late night screening of either Creature from Black Lake, which is a Bigfoot movie, or Legend of Boggy Creek. Whatever it was, it scared the hell out of me. And once we found out, and Curse of Bigfoot used to run on Detroit TV a lot too. So once we found out the Pacific Northwest is where Bigfoot lived, and we were going there anyway, my brother Donald and I were obsessed with Bigfoot. You know what I mean? I mean, I was just terrified of Bigfoot killing me in the tent, killing everyone in the tent. So to be hunkered down in a tree while a buxom blonde is looking for me, about to jump out at her, it was a really surreal experience, let me tell you, Sherpa.
Let's talk a little bit about your 90s music video cred. You were in the Tom Petty, It's Good to Be King.
Wow, very good. Yes, I was in Tom Petty's It's Good to Be King. And the weird thing is I'm the silver king in that. I'm the sun king. And I remember the director was cool, but very art damaged. And he's French. And so at one point, he goes, I want Pat's sun king to take a wide drag of a cigarette and blow the smoke at the camera. And the makeup girl, who doesn't want to get in trouble, whispers to me, it's highly flammable. She goes, if you can get him to not do that in a way that saves your face, then my job would be really appreciated. And, you know, I'm looking at him and go, I just gave up, man. I just gave up smoking. I never smoked in my life, but I was trying to save her job too. I said, I just gave up. And my doctor said, if I start smoking again, it'll be an addiction for the rest of my life. And he goes like this, okay, I'm losing my shot, but I don't want you to be a lifelong smoker. And Tom Petty, who was smoking every 5 minutes, just looked at me, shrugged, and took a long drag.
All right, tell me about working with the kangaroo.
Okay, the kangaroo was from my Incubus video. So my stupid superpower is I can run as fast as a dog in all forms. Once you do it, when you go out for a music video, you're brought in, you've got literally 2 frigging minutes to, you've got 2 minutes in the room, and if you're not a smoking hot chick, they look at you and they think, what can you do that I haven't seen 40 times before? Well, for me, since I'm 6'9", doubling over and running as fast as a dog would kind of knock them out. Once you do it, he goes, and I remember one, on one of my videos, he kept shooting and shooting the audition guy, and the girl goes, aren't you going to cut it? And he goes, oh, yeah. But he just kept staring at me because it freaked him out. So I did this weird video, a cool video. The director had also done a really talented female director. It was Incubus. It was called Talk Show on Mute, which is a great song anyway. Floria Sigismondi directed it. She also did Donald's throwing her IMDb to my left ear. Yeah. Flora Sigismondi also did the Runaways movie. She's a really talented director, cool chick. You know, I mean, cool chick, but she had a really wild point of view. In this video, and again, I do a lot of creatures, so it was really weird. I'm one of the humans in the video, and all the people in the all the people in the video are pets for the animal people. So there are animals, and it was amazing prosthetics work. So everywhere you looked was animals. They had these beautiful, stunning Russian models that they turned into Siamese cats. I remember going to the bathroom, and I looked to my right at we're at the urinals. There's a dog on my right, and there's a horse on my left. I mean, perfect, man. They can't take them off. But the horse and the dog are looking at me, and I'm looking at them, and we're all in a urinals. So it was very strange. So, you know, but that's one of the ones that, so I, most of the time with my dog run, I'm the human, which is really weird because I thought horror movies would jump at that. But Stan Winston kept bringing me in, and he told me, you know, like he goes, I tried to get humans who could run like you on Planet of the Apes and Wrong Turn. I went in for one of the Wrong Turns. They shot in Canada, and Stan, they shot in Canada, and they told him, you can find the monsters here. And Stan Winston had pushed me for the role. And then I ran into him at a Comic-Con party or something, and Stan whispers to me, The girl in the Wrong Turn movie set the guy up for your part on fire. So he goes, feel better because he set the girl, the Canadian guy who got your part got set on fire by the girl. And I said, well, thanks, Stan, I guess, for that, you know, because it was Canadian. They only wanted the monsters to be Canadian. The girl was American. But, and so Stan told me, you were robbed because, you know, he goes, you are my number one choice for the creature. So what happened is, so I'm doing this video with Incubus, and I'm a pet of the animal people, and we're on a show called Stupid Human Tricks, where the pets have to come on and then do their routines. And they cleared it around for everybody when they brought in this kangaroo. And he was a young Joey. He wasn't that old. He was like 2. But he had a 6-foot kickspan. And the trainer told me, he goes, and I go, you know, it's been a joke on Popeye and Mickey Mouse and Smurfs and all this. Kangaroos kick you and you're knocked out. And he goes, kangaroos are no joke. They've been known on the outback. And he wasn't joking. He was dead serious. They could disembowel people and prey from time to time. If they're in a, you know, a kangaroo, as cute as they are, I guess they're incredibly dirty fighters. And the kangaroo was adorable. I mean, he got nervous at one part, and you never even saw him move. He was like 3 feet tall, but he had a 6-foot kickspan. He got nervous, slipped forward, and kicked his feet out. And nobody saw it coming. Nobody was behind him. But if anyone had been behind him, they would have been knocked out. Isn't that amazing? I mean, you never think of a kangaroo of all things, you know, but incredibly deadly. But The band was cool. The makeup effects were neat. And doing this video, it was such a trippy video. You know what I mean? I mean, you do something like that. I remember I did the dog run in this Hotel Roslyn, which you see in Fight Club and 7 and other movies, this really rundown Hollywood hotel. And when the band was celebrating, when the video was so popular, and the band came to town, and I was asked to introduce them at the Viper Room. And that was really trippy because I'm introducing the band, and Johnny Depp was personally tending bar. You know, Johnny Depp handed me a scotch after I introduced him. Good intro. And he hands you a scotch, and you're thinking, this is so surreal. You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
And the band is there, and they're all being feeded because this one silly video, and it was so big, it got them out of Pittsburgh and brought them, they flew them all the way to L.A. for this, you know?
You have several books out, and I know they're really, like, really detailed tomes of pop culture. That's what your real love is with writing.
To me, and again, and it's all stuff that there hadn't been books on any of the things. I mean, of course, I wrote 3 books. I have a 4th one I'm trying to finish, Quarantine Willing. I'm trying to get it all, you know, done, you know. But I wrote Just When You Thought It Was Safe, A Jaws Companion, on all 4 Jaws movies. You Wouldn't Like Me When I'm Angry, an Incredible Hulk companion, forward by Lou Ferrigno, Stan Lee's in it. And the last one was kind of my publisher's idea, but I stand by all my books. Buck Rogers and the 25th Century, a TV companion, and a really sweet forward by Aaron Grant. I did, because like you mentioned earlier, writing for Fangoria and Starlog, I covered a lot of these things. I had all these interviews with people who worked on these different projects, and it just struck me there wasn't a book on all four Jaws movies. And as every publisher who rejected it kept telling me, it's because the other three are terrible. But but I wanted to know about the other three Jaws movies. That's why I wrote that book. I mean, I wanted to know stuff about the original Jaws nobody knew. But at the same time, I also wanted to know what in the hell this was all about, you know? I wanted the story. And Jaws was my first book. And I interviewed all the victims of the original shark. I put everything in there that I, as a kid, would have wanted from any, you know, as a kid, you love Godzilla, you love Michael Myers, you love Jason, you love Chucky. And you want to know which Chucky has the highest death toll, you know, how does Chucky die in this one? So to do the Jaws book, I wanted to know how each shark died. I wanted the shark stats, you know, 25 feet, 3 tons for the first one. Jaws the Revenge, even though he looks like crap, is only 23 feet long. I don't know why. And he has the lowest death toll in the movie. He only kills one person. When you see the final movie, he kills two people, actually. One in the Bahamas and one in Amity. And then he'd actually killed three people originally, but one of the guys was allowed to live in the TV version, so we couldn't count him. You know, I wanted a book covering all this. Hulk was the first success Marvel Comics had outside of the comic books, long before the movies. You know, they did Hulk and Spider-Man, but Hulk was the runaway critical success and the ratings one. So I got to do what I wanted to do, which was and that was the book that would not die. You know what I mean? I mean, because I've written for Marvel Comics. I'd had a bunch of conversations with Stan Lee. I had all this material. And unfortunately, the book is 2 pounds. I mean, if you buy the book on Amazon, you wouldn't like me when I'm angry, I'll companion. If you buy the book on Amazon, it is 2 freaking pounds. And that's because I could not stop writing it. There's 50 pages on the origin of the Hulk in the comic book. And then there's another 500 on the TV series, the movies, the TV movies. Lou Ferrigno, the people behind the show. I talked to 110 guests of the show and writers and directors and producers. That was one of those books where I didn't so much have to turn it in. I had to have a couple of my brothers tear it out of my hands and send it off, because I would still be running that damn thing, because every story led to another story. By the time I was done with the series, it was like 91 episodes. Then I cover the next three TV movies. Then I cover Ang Lee's Hulk, and then the Edward Norton Hulk. And then just as everything was done and going to bed, I Love You Man came out. And, you know, you can't do a book on the Lou Ferrigno Hulk and not have I Love You Man. So I got the director, and it was literally, I would still be writing that damn book if it were today. Can you imagine trying to write it after Avengers? I'd have to have Avengers and Ultron and all of that other stuff. I couldn't get that book in the mail. You know, I couldn't hit send fast enough to the publisher on the computer. That was Vietnam. It was one of those books where, you know, you lose the daylight. You lose yourself. I mean, you're thinking, how many episodes? How many? And I remember it was 91 episodes. And I remember wanting to throw the book against the wall on episode 17, because it was just so difficult. I had to look on the date it first aired and everything else. It was just murder. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm happy the book is beloved, but I hope that people appreciate it, because that book was effing murder.
It's a good thing you didn't title it "You Wouldn't Like Me When My Hands Are All Cramped Up from Doing All That Typing."
Literally. And I kept hoping not to. When I was mid-deep in it, when I remember I was at the Seattle. I was covering the Emerald City Comic Con in Seattle. And my sister and my sister Diane and her husband Jim and their kids were with me. You know, and I was doing interviews there, and the kids were shopping, and Jim and Diane were just having a good time. And my sister, it's my big sister, so when she makes a suggestion, it's usually I usually follow it, younger brother syndrome, you know what I mean? And she goes, you want to ask Lou. He's right over there. You want to ask Lou to write the foreword. And I remember walking up to Lou Ferrigno, and my nephew is like 10 or 11. He's looking at me with these big eyes, very excited. He's going to meet the Hulk. And I remember thinking, man, if Lou says he won't do it in front of my sister's family, I'm going to run home and delete everything I have and pretend I never thought of it. And instead, damn it, Lou thought it was a great idea and excitedly told me he was down with it. It's like, I'm stuck. I've got to finish the damn thing. Because if Lou said, who has the time to run a forward, I would have thought, yes, I'm done. I'm off the cross. Sadly, Lou thought it was a great idea, so I was on for the entire afternoon.
I know your podcast, The Jeff and Janky Show, is currently on a little bit of a hiatus right now. What type of shows did you guys do? So for the people that have never heard of it.
Sure. Well, it's a California. I mean, anybody can watch it on YouTube. Just if you hit Jeff and Janky, and Jeff, that idiot, my co-host, misspelled Janky, so it's J-A-N-K-I. It's weird. It fits our schedule because Jeff sculpts stuff for the studios, and I'm doing a writing, and so when we'll do that, we keep the show running. Well, you know, if I have an audition or something, it's usually like 2 or later in the day. And my other jobs, I don't have to start till after. We did a pop culture show, and we're obsessed with pop culture, as you noted. And we would have people come on the show to talk about their experiences. Character actors, we had a character actor who'd worked with Robert Shaw. We had Jeff East come in, you know, Jeff East, who played Clark Kent, young Superman, and Superman the movie. He was in that really fun, terrible Animal House ripoff, Up the Creek, and Pumpkinhead. He's the last guy standing in Pumpkinhead. So we would have these cool people, and they were very cool people, and they'd come in at 6 or 7 in the morning to do the show. We had TSOL, we had all these punk bands and other, we had actresses come on. I mean, just cool people would come in and do the show, and they'd be with us for like 3 hours. We would have Tiffany Shepis come in, and Jim O'Jaw, who's a big effects guy, his entire cast and crew came in on one show for his horror movie, Strange Wilderness. We had all sorts of, on our Halloween shows, we would have Veronica Carlson, the Hammer Screen Queen, would be on with us every Halloween morning. We had Scotty Schwartz come in from Christmas Story. He did a ton of other stuff. But he would tell his Christmas story, working with Richard Pryor on The Toy, the beautiful redhead from several Clint Eastwood movies. To me, it's always a lot of fun to have these people come in. This is why this COVID quarantine is boring the hell out of me. All my interviews, the best ones, I would rather sit across from you over a cup of coffee and talk. I mean, I can see your face, which is why an interview like this is good. Phoners, man. I die on the vine on phoners. I hate phone interviews. I like in person. Don't you? You know, as fun as this is, when you're across the table from somebody, there's more of an intimacy and immediacy to it, you know?
You've talked to a lot of amazing directors and producers, too. Some of the biggest names in Hollywood.
The point is, and then when you do that, Jim, when you do that in person, what are you going to ask James Cameron? That's not going to bore him. You know, you want to ask him questions that keep him thinking. When you're on the set, and you're interviewing Christina Ricci, or you're interviewing Bill Pullman or Bill Paxton, you want them interested. You want to ask questions that. I don't want anybody phoning it in. Yeah, you're going to have to ask about aliens, or you're going to have to ask about this or that. But you also got to ask about stuff that will make them animated and interesting. Like Bill Paxton was fantastic. He was working on this crappy alien movie when we did the interview. And we're in Long Beach. And at one point he goes, it's break. He goes, let's go have a beer in that cantina. And he got up and we were going to leave, and the publicist put her arms across the door and said, Bill, you cannot take the press to the cantina. That's not right. And he goes, you mean I'm already here making Plan 10 from outer space and I can't be honest with my friends in the press? And you love the guy. He would tell you great stories. One of his best stories is, you remember the creep he played in True Lies?
Yeah, I saw it a while ago. Yeah.
He plays a used car dealer who pretends to be a secret agent. And when he does this, he's doing his sensitive secret special agent voice. And he laughed and said he was goofing to James Cameron. They were goofing on Michael Biehn, the intense guy from all those movies they did together for James Cameron, Terminator Aliens. So he was goofing, and Michael Biehn would do that, the sensitive action guy voice. So Bill Paxton was doing that voice to make James Cameron. that's a great story. You know, he's not going to share that unless you get that. You know, it's like asking a girl to dance. You've got 2 minutes to, you got 10 seconds to get her to agree to dance. You got 2 minutes to make an impression. And I mean, I've done the round table. You do a round table with some of the biggest idiots in the world, you know. And I mean, so there are some great reporters and great press. But I remember interviewing Mark Wahlberg, and there was an Australian guy. And I know, and this is the round tables. And this Australian guy kept shouting over everyone else, telling him, make a muscle, make a muscle. He's trying to promote a movie. And the Australian guy leans over and squeezes his muscle. Who's that for other than the Australian guy? And I got tapped by the publicist and said, Wahlberg liked your questions. He wants to know if you want to do a one-on-one. But a round table, you're a sled dog. You're in a harness with like 8 other people. And you're at a table full of people. And most of the questions are terrible. And most of the questions are canned. And you've got to make an impression. And you've got to ask a question that's worth asking. And if they like the question, then you suddenly, the publicist pulls you aside and says, hey, listen, blah, 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 I like you. You want to do the interview over here? I mean, that's how I got a one-on-one with Charlize Theron, Natalie Portman, and all this. If you ask intelligent questions, you get intelligent answers, and you get an intelligent interview. You ask Zack Snyder something he hasn't been asked a million times. And I mean, Snyder was amazing. Snyder was, you know, just amazing people. You talk to like the co-creator of Watchmen, Dave Gibbons, you know, the comic Watchmen, and he'll start telling you as a Brit, he drew water towers all through Watchmen because they grew up on American comic books and London is freezing. So they don't have any water towers in England. But as kids, he said, him and Alan Moore were obsessed with water towers in Spider-Man comics. They were obsessed that buildings, because it was so cold in London, they couldn't imagine anybody would need to put a water tower on top of their office building. So that's a great answer. You know what I mean? I mean, like running for Starlog and Star Trek, I'm kind of bored interviewing the regulars on the show. What are you going to ask Lieutenant Uhura that she hasn't been answered in a million times before for 50 some years? I want the guest star. I want the guest star. This was a car payment. And they can't believe this piece of crap sci-fi thing is following. Those are the best interviews. Asking the guy who murders Captain Kirk's crew member by turning them into a cube. Asking the guy who played the Greek god Apollo, well, what it's like to be recognized 40, 50 some years later from this franchise. That to me is the real question. It's like being a one-hit wonder. You know, all these character actors, they had a good career. Oh, they did a Mission Impossible. They did a Batman. But the Star Trek stuff, their Star Trek guest appearance has been fetishized to the point where they can't believe it's important to them. I mean, you do enough Star Trek interviews. Though the other thing they can't believe is in those days, you were only paid for the first 6 episodes. No more. Yeah. Julie Newmar got her last check as Catwoman and for her alien babe on Star Trek. Her last check was in the early 70s. They weren't getting anything. So it became kind of a winning lottery ticket for these people to find out that their Star Trek episode, you know what I mean? I mean, suddenly they're in demand in the convention circuit. And to me, that's a fascinating interview. Did you know this entirely different thing would open up to you, you know?
And I guess when you have that cult following on the show, you know, that people follow it with such detail, and these people become stars in a whole different light.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, to me, it was sort of like being a one-hit wonder. I mean, they would be feeling bad that they never starred in the movie. They're always a heavy or a henchman or something. But they'd turn around and they would say, I had no idea I would pay more attention on Star Trek if I knew it was such a big deal, you know? And I like the story. It's like being a one-hit wonder from a 60s music group. The cute blonde space hippie telling you her story. She's now a really talented painter. But she tells you her story and then realizing that this thing had a cult following and that's all people wanted to talk about. Even big character actors like Charles Napier, you know, who's probably best known as he's the hillbilly who wants to kill the Blues Brothers, and he's the guy Hannibal Lecter strings up on the cage in Silence of the Lambs. He was on a Star Trek, and he couldn't believe. He goes, I worked with Russ Meyer, and people want to talk about my space hippie on Star Trek. You know, it weirded him out, you know?
You know, before I let you go, the last time that we spoke, it was Taco Tuesday, and I didn't even realize when we rescheduled Taco Tuesday again.
Oh, it is Taco Tuesday. You know what? The weird thing is my brother, after you're right, it's about the high holy day in the Jenkins family calendar is Taco Tuesday. The weird thing about it last night is I told Donald, my brother Donald, I was going on a walk last night, and I said, hey, tomorrow's Taco Tuesday. And he goes, let's go tonight. So I mean, we went last night, we had our tacos, we had what they call the stoner burrito, which is a burrito where it's like 75 cents extra, but they put French fries and all this good stuff in it. So I'm not saying we're stoners, but stoners eat it at like 3 a.m. So it's no, you ask them for the stoner burrito, they know exactly what you mean. Do you have Del Taco in New York? I mean, Long Island?
No, unfortunately, we don't.
You really missed out. I mean, I know they have them in Arizona now. Del Taco is, to me, it's what separates us. It isn't In-N-Out Burger, which people swear by, or Coney Island back in Michigan. To me, you're not in California until you do Taco Tuesday at Del Taco. It's the best. I'm sure it's all horrible for you, but it's the best finger-licking food on earth. I can't rave it up enough, you know?
Okay. Is there anything else that we have to look forward to seeing you in, Pat? Anything coming up?
Yes. Yeah. You just made me think of something. My dog run. If you want to see me dog running, I'm in I'm sure I'm going to screw it up. I'm in a Danny Trejo classic, and the Prey. It's like this Predator type movie where they go to Iraq. We shot in Iraq, which means we shot in the Antelope Valley on the set for Iron Man from Iraq. They wake an ancient horror, me, this four-legged thingamabob. I look like a spider and a monkey and all this other stuff. So I chase a bunch of soldiers around for 90 minutes on all fours eating them. You won't recognize me. I have like 8 eyes in it. But yeah, the trailer's online. I think it's called Prey of the Hunted. Whatever it is, it's on IMDb. It's released later this year. Danny Trejo is in it, and I'm the only one you won't recognize. The thing on all fours chasing people around. Carnoctis. My name is Carnoctis. I run on all fours. I was bitching to you. I couldn't get cast all these horror movies like Hells of Eyes and all this with guys running, with monsters running on all fours. And they would use CG or they would, or the Planet of the Apes. Stan Winston said, the problem with a guy like you is you can really do it. We cheat it for everyone else. So he goes, so the last thing anybody wants in the room is a guy who can really run in all fours because you'll make everyone they're faking look bad. So I was both complimented and depressed. But yeah, this is a monster where you'll see me on all fours running around eating people.
And as long as the tacos taste better than the soldiers, that's the important thing, right?
The tacos taste much better than the soldiers. No spit bucket here.
Okay, his name is Pat Jankiewicz. Pat, thank you so much for the redo, sir.
Jim, the honor was mine. Now, in exchange for being on your show, you have next time you're breaking quarantine, you have to drive by the Amityville Horror House and honk your horn, okay?
One of these days we have to get you out here so you can actually see it in person.
I am frigging dying to see it. I'm going to swear here, but only because it's in the service of friend's story. I had another friend from Long Island. In fact, one of the great Long Island people is Elliot. Elliot, who puts on Monster Palooza, is from Long Island. And I had another friend who said when they were kids, they would ride their bike. They would ride their bikes around the Amityville Horror neighborhood, waiting for someone to come out of the house. And my friend would describe the story to me, riding his bike up and down all day with his brother, waiting for people. So the current owners of the Amityville Horror House would come out, and every kid in the neighborhood would suddenly ride their bikes into the driveway, you know, doing circles. Hey, this poor woman is on her way to the grocery store or something, and hey, you saw any ghosts? And he said, even though they're like 8 and 10, the woman would look over at them and go fuck yourself. That's Pig Long Island right there, I think.
All right, Mr. Pat, I will let you go, sir. Thank you again so much.
Thank you for leading me through the Barren Wastelands podcast, Sherpa. I had a great time, Jim. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening, and thank you so much to Mr. Pat Jankowicz. Really enjoyed having him. We got to keep an eye open for some of the stuff that he's coming out with. The guy is so cool. And if you want to follow the show on social media, it's Sherpalution at Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. And of course, you can listen to the show on your favorite podcast app or my website, Sherpalution.com. Don't forget, this is Hollywood Week, so please stay tuned and enjoy. I'm Jim the Podcast Sherpa, and Mr. Bruce, show us off with that cool new ending. But if you could escort everybody out the door first, really appreciate it. Look, there's Bigfoot.
Thanks for listening to the Sherpa Screening Room. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast. I'm Mr. Bruce, and this has been a Sherpaloo Studios production. Viva la Sherpalution!